It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness, the loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.
Hey friends, this is Kurt Frankum, the host of the Leading LDS Podcast. So you've had a little radio silence, as they say in the business. I haven't been able to post as many interviews and stuff. I've just been busy, but I should find a rhythm pretty soon here. Lots of stuff going on, but nonetheless, I love leading LDS and the passion I have for and interviewing these leaders. And I'm really always striving to be proactive about getting more out there. And I've gotten several emails from individuals just thanking me for how the information on leading LDS has impacted their ability as leaders. So I appreciate those emails. And anytime you want to send those emails to me, it really keeps me going. So I'd be interested in hear what items you've applied and done to make your leadership better. So I've been so busy. I missed chapter 18 doing a teacher teaching help for chapter 18, and many people emailed me and demanded to know where it was. But the reality is, only 24 hours in a day, and that one I just couldn't do. So, but I got chapter 19 and chapter 20 out already. So if you are teaching in your third hour of Sunday school, or priesthood, that is, or Relief Society, check that out. And I just share some ideas of what you can do in during your lesson to teach that topic, just some unique ideas and such. They're just my ideas, not the world's greatest by any means, but they felt people. So feel free to check that out and share it with other teachers that teach that lesson. So today we're back at it with a how I lead. Excuse me. I got getting over a head cold here. A how I lead interview with Chance Mikos, and he's a bishop down in Arizona in El Mirage. And he talks about that, and really fantastic interview. This guy's full of some great tips and knowledge. We talk about his upbringing in the church, his mission to Boise, Idaho, the blessing it was to be called in leadership positions at a young age, and how that has impacted him now that he's serving as a bishop. He is a past Elders Quorum president. We talk about his time on High Council, programs he's put into place, pushing people towards the temple, loving people. Even some how he uses Trello, which is a project management system, to really hit a home run in his calling. And so we covered all. Really good interview. I listen to all my podcasts double time because I can still comprehend it. So feel free to speed this up if you need to, but every second is worth listening to. So here is my interview with Chance Mikos. How are you, Chance?
I'm doing great. Great. Good to hear from you, Kurt.
Good. Well, I appreciate you taking a few moments today, and we're going to chat about how you lead. And like most people that are that come to this segment of the Leading LDS Podcast, they think, you know what? I've got nothing to share, nothing special. But as we start talking, everybody has a unique approach. Excuse me. Everybody has a unique approach to leadership. And I think we'll discover what those unique approaches you have are. And so, just to summarize before we get into your background, what is your calling?
I'm currently serving as the Bishop of the El Mirage Ward out here in Arizona.
Nice. What part of Arizona?
So El Mirage is a little town just west of Phoenix. I guess you could call us a suburb of Phoenix. We're actually, honestly, we're almost a suburb of a smaller town called Surprise. So we're the little brother of Surprise.
Okay, basically. I've heard of Surprise, Arizona, just because of the uniqueness of the name. So cool.
Yep.
And how long have you lived there? Are you born and raised in Arizona? Or
yeah, I'm an Arizona native. Lived out in the El Mirage area since 2000.
Oh, cool.
So about 15 years. Yep.
Right on. Now, take us back a little bit to your upbringing. Was it a pretty traditional Arizonian Mormon upbringing, or were you born in the church? Tell us kind of that development of your testimony in the church.
Sure. My probably not your traditional LDS upbringing in the beginning. My father was born a member to a part member family and lived in California. Sometime when he was in his teenage years, we've never nailed him down on it. He became, I guess you would call, less active. His mom really didn't make him go to church. He wasn't really into scouts, so kind of found other things to do, mostly surfing. And he kind of lost his way there for a little while. Went to Vietnam, actually came home, married my mother, who was a non-member. And all I can remember the details of it, I was about 5 years old and the missionaries came to our door. We always had a good home teacher who I think probably set the whole thing up, who was very diligent about making sure my brother and I got to primary. That's when they used to do it, like on a Wednesday, I think it was, or a Tuesday or something. But long story short, the missionaries showed up and started teaching my mom and my brother. My brother was 8 at the time. And they just jumped in feet first, and my dad never looked back. A year later, they went to the temple and we got to go with them, sealed in the Mesa, Arizona temple. And
wow,
and
great.
From there, it's, you know, it's pretty traditional. I mean, dad served as a scoutmaster, served in the bishopric, mom served in all kinds of callings. And then of course, you know, I ended up in deacon's quorum and teacher's quorum presidencies and Eagle Scout, you know, the whole thing. So
great. And then did you later serve a mission?
Yep, I was able to serve in the Boise, Idaho mission, actually.
Oh, exotic.
Yeah, exactly. Didn't go too far from home, but what a great place. I mean, I loved everything about it. I grew up in a big city, and you know, Boise for Idaho is a big city, but for where I'm from was not big. And so it was just... It was an adventure for me, I'll be honest. I started in the Boise area and then ended up serving about 6 months in a little town called Weezer, Idaho, which was just paradise to me. I mean, it was the coolest place I'd ever been. So I loved everything about it, all 24 and a half months of it.
Nice. Nice. So it's always a joke, especially for Utah Mormons, that, okay, got your mission call. You're probably going to Pocatello or Boise. So what was the experience like reading Boise, Idaho when you got your mission call?
It's funny that you asked that, actually. It's one of my favorite stories. My priest quorum was rather large, and we were really tight. I mean, we did everything together. We had a great quorum. And so all my buddies were getting mission calls, and I was having dreams in Spanish. And so, you know, living in Arizona, you know, going to high school, taking Spanish classes, I was convinced I was going somewhere Spanish speaking, and my very closest friend, we got our mission calls on the same day, and his dad got home before mine did. And so he opened his up and I was listening on the phone, and he gets a call to Montevideo, Uruguay. And I'm like, oh man, this is awesome. I'm going Spanish, you know?
Yeah.
And opened it up, and the two elders at my house, believe it or not, were both that were serving in my ward had come over. I was serving as a stake missionary at the time of my call. Kind of had a cool program in my stake where they, you know, everybody that submitted papers got called as stake missionaries. And anyway, the missionaries were over, and they were both from Idaho, one from Eastern Idaho, but one from my mission area. And I opened the call and I said, Boise, Idaho. And everybody just laughed. They thought I was joking. And, not sure enough.
And you went, huh?
Yeah. And I'll be honest, I was pumped, from the word go. I had a really good conversation with my stake president. He said, listen, you're going to do a lot of good there. So, you know, great people and great opportunities. And so I just loved it.
Cool.
It was a little bit, you know, not Spanish speaking, but that didn't last long at all. Not even probably an hour. You know, I was just pumped, you know, getting ready to go.
Great. Cool. Yeah. My experience was similar, going to Sacramento, you know, just 9 hours down I-80. I thought, man, what, This isn't a mission, right? But luckily, I was saved by the fact it said I was a Spanish speaking missionary, so I felt at least I get a language out of it. So,
yeah.
But that's cool. That's a great experience.
To Idaho speaking Idahoan, man. It doesn't get any more meat and potatoes than that.
Nice, you know? Nice, wonderful. So you came over from your mission and went to school, I assume, got married. What was that? What did that lead you to?
Yeah, so came home, actually met my wife, hadn't known her before the mission, and met my wife like 3 days after I got home, just completely by, that's another story for another time, but just totally by, I guess it's not by chance, it was, I'm certain that it was Heavenly Father looking out for me, but got into school, got my wife through school, she was almost done. When we got married, I was kind of working and going to school at night and in the day whenever I could find time, and ended up moving out to this side of town and quickly got put into the church leadership. So actually school took a back seat for a while. So just life got in the way and started doing some other things that were exciting and new and kind of went through the school of hard knocks, I guess you could say.
Nice. And where's your career landed you now? What do you do for a living?
I'm self-employed. I've owned a business, a small insurance business for about 8 years now, and it's been good to us. And actually before that I had been in outside sales, which kind of pulled me away from school, along with multiple church callings that were pretty demanding as well. So
cool. And what were some of those early on church callings that you were asked to serve in?
Well, I got made elders quorum president shortly after we moved out here. And El Mirage is, like I said, it's kind of a little brother to Surprise, which has had just amazing growth over the last 15 or 20 years. Just, it's a boom town almost. And so moved into a ward where the ward was huge. There was, every time we went to, and I guess I should qualify that, you know, huge for Arizona standards, but you go to church and it was like state conference, you know, all the way back to the end, back of the cultural hall. And I mean, there's probably, you know, 500 or 600 in attendance every Sunday, just because it was growing so quickly. The church couldn't, you know, was struggling to keep up with buildings. And so I got called as the second elders quorum president in a ward. So there was two elders quorums formed and I was the second one or the first, I don't know, whatever the other one. Was over a quickly growing area. So lots of moving in of people, lots of meeting brand new faces. Every Sunday it was 5 or 6 new families. And so very, very time consuming, to keep up with everything that was going on. And I was young at the time too. Had many opportunities on my mission to serve in leadership, but this was kind of my first, you're on your own type deal. And so, a lot of learning from through experiences of, setting up, districts and home teaching routes and getting guys motivated. The blessing was that with it being a newer community, there was a lot of young families. So had a lot of return missionaries, great guys and families to be able to work with. And it was a lot of fun.
Cool. Now, so I assume there were two elders quorums in that ward. Was that ward soon after split were the only elders quorum?
So the ward split and I was the only elders quorum president there for about, I don't even know, 4 or 5 months. And then they put me in the bishopric. I was 26 and I was called as a second counselor in the bishopric. So so that's where things got really crazy for me. So
now in that time of the being an elders quorum president, and how long would you say you were elders quorum president?
I think a little over a year was all.
Oh, okay. So, and then you moved into the bishopric.
Yeah.
Okay. And maybe this is a question for both those callings, but in a ward that is quickly growing and, you know, the church is having a hard time keeping up with buildings and splitting wards and those types of things, what were the consistent problems or concerns that came up in presidency meetings or bishopric meetings that you felt like you were constantly trying to find unique ways to approach or to solve?
I think the biggest concern or biggest issue that we dealt with was keeping up with making sure everybody felt like they were welcome. You know, you could easily get lost in a ward that big. And we had a lot of good families. And so my situation has completely changed now. I'm sure we'll get into that. But at the time it was, you know, meet with people would move in, we'd get their records, we'd get them pulled in, and then we'd go try to make personal visits to them and make sure that they, you know, felt like they were welcome and part of the ward, and actually trying to analyze what it is that we could use them for the help to do, you know, whatever callings they could do in the ward. It was a lot of, and then honestly, it was a ton of moving. I mean, yeah. Every weekend I had one or two moves I'd either be on or had to coordinate. So that first while, I mean, it was a lot. So, you know, we had guys that were just straight up on the moving committee. I mean, that was their calling, was just to help people unload U-Haul trailers and, you know, whatever. Wow. So it was pretty exciting, just because everything was so new and every week you got to make new friends. So,
yeah. And so with the, so you sort of faced a problem of you had a ton of very worthy, capable people there. You know, there's only one bishop in a ward, but there probably are 30 people who could be bishop, or there's, you know, one elders quorum president, but there's probably 50 that could be elders quorum president. So it was a trick of helping everybody feel like they're useful without just saying, hey, you're the hymn book organizer. And is that a good way to explain it?
No, that's great. No, I appreciate that. That's a great characterization. And now that I look back, so, you know, looking back 15 years, most of those guys that moved in or that I helped move in have either been bishops, high councilmen, you know what I mean? It's, you know, they've all found their place, to serve and to lead and to do great things. So, but yeah, you're right. It was very difficult to make sure everybody felt like they were needed. You know, we had so many brethren that we organized. I didn't know any other way to do it, so I organized my home teaching just like a mission. I had my two counselors were basically the APs, and then I had zone leaders and then even district leaders below them. And so a lot of those zone leaders and district leaders, you know, could have been elders quorum presidents. That's how lucky I was in that situation, you know, so.
And then maybe dig into that a little bit more, but as far as the details of how that was set up, what did the zone leaders do and what did the district leaders do as far as running home teaching?
I'm going to have to go back and try to do some total recall here.
Sorry.
But the district or the zone leaders basically were motivators. The district leaders did all the reporting. They did all the, meeting with the, the companionships and trying to, try to keep things going. We would once a month, we would have a, kind of a zone leader meeting at my house. And so my presidency would be there, and then we'd have a meeting where we would just discuss, okay, what's going on? Who needs help? And it was almost because there was just so much that we were trying to take full advantage of or making most efficient the time that we had, just trying to get to the bottom of who was where and what they needed and things like that. And we had and really our job as the presidency at the time was to keep those guys motivated. You know, we were kind of a blessing for us was that the other elders quorum at the time, while we were still all one ward, they were led by an unbelievable elders quorum president. This guy is a dear friend to this day, but was very capable And they were pushing, 70-80% home teaching every month. And so we were always trying to keep up with them, which was a blessing, I think, to force us to work harder. And so we were constantly trying to make tweaks, and we knew it was possible because those other guys were doing it. And so we were, and I worked a lot with that other Elders Quorum president and, trying to figure out what they were doing. And so we really, I tell people all the time, I'd rather be a pirate than a pioneer. So I just stole as much as I could from what he was doing. And we set it up and did a lot of the same things, which ultimately came down to, I'll be honest, there, I know there's a huge, this is a big philosophy issue in the church, but my thinking was people need the visits. And if it's the home teacher, if the home teacher is not going to do it or can't do it, then I got to figure out a way to get those people visited. And right or wrong, that was kind of my philosophy at the time. And so we were out a lot. I was out probably two nights a week. And then most of the day, Sunday, trying to keep up with just meeting people and making sure everybody was accounted for. And then most of the zone leaders were doing the same thing. What they would do is the zone leaders and the district leaders, if we had a companionship that just wasn't functioning, we'd give that companionship a call and we'd say, hey, listen, we know your families haven't been seen here in a month or two. We're going to go ahead and make those appointments. Can you be available on this day to go with us and meet your families? So that seemed to work pretty well. I think that was part of the problem is that we had some companionships that were hesitant, just because they didn't know the families who they were going to see. So we were trying to break that ice for them. And usually that only took one or two attempts and we would convert them, into pretty diligent home teachers. I can't say completely, but they would at least make the attempts to make sure everybody was seen. So,
yeah, that's great. And I think Elders Quorum presidents that are listening that maybe have a very large Elders Quorum. I know when I was Elders Quorum president, we had well over 96 elders, which is the max for a quorum for elders. But just that model, that, like you mentioned, the mission model, right? Having zone leaders and district leaders. And I think district leaders are pretty traditional a calling in most Elders Quorum. But I like how you made that additional layer of zone leaders that were sort of the motivators, because I think most Elders Quorum presidents, they sort of see their role as the motivator. And if you get too many people, it's hard to connect. You're just trying to motivate on a very large scale. And so I really like that. And then even the competition of having another Elders Quorum in your ward, that the dynamic of a competition is one motivating factor. I think that's,
yeah, and definitely a luxury if you have a big ward. Now,
yeah,
that's the ward I serve in now. We don't have that luxury, but that was, I said earlier, we were trying to make sure everybody had something to do, and all these guys could have been Elders Quorum presidents. So
yeah, that's great. And what a way to utilize them. They probably did feel like leaders. They felt enabled, to lead and to take some of that burden off your shoulders. And I think it'd be, those that don't have two Elders Quorums in your ward, which is the majority of wards, you could go to the next ward in your stake and say, hey, why don't we put a little competition together? Obviously you don't want to drain the sincerity out of that program, but making it a game is a powerful a factor of getting people motivated to do difficult things. So
especially, say this the right way, especially men,
the competitive nature, right?
Competitive nature is definitely something that I think most of us have. So
cool. All right. So you're Elders Quorum president and then put in the bishopric as the second counselor. How long did you serve in the bishopric?
The full five. Well, we were 5+ years.
Okay.
So
from beginning to end of that bishop's term.
Yep.
Gotcha. Cool. Any unique challenges in that time? Was it for the same ward that you were Elders Quorum president?
Yeah. So they split that ward.
Okay.
Actually, there was probably a brief, when they split the ward, I was still the Elders Quorum president. And I think it was about, 6 or 8 months. And then the other second counselor got called as like the stake executive secretary. So there was the opening, and then I took that spot. So it wasn't the entire, it was roughly 4.5 years probably that I served there. So they split that ward. And in fact, I've lived in the same neighborhood. I've moved from a couple houses, you know, upsizing houses, but in the same neighborhood the whole time I've been in El Mirage. And I think I've lived in 4 wards. Never, you know, it's just been split, you know?
Yeah.
Actually, I think 3 stakes, no, 2 stakes and 4 wards or something like that.
And you've been in the same house the whole time.
In the same neighborhood.
Same neighborhood.
You know, within a few blocks.
Wow.
So there's been a lot of growth. It's slowed just because the little town I'm in is run out of land. We've basically built it out. So I'm a little bit landlocked as a unit now. And the demographics have completely changed, which is interesting that it can do that quickly. But, some of the challenges that we had there was, again, we were meeting in buildings that were not even in our stake because they hadn't built anything yet. So we were kind of the orphaned ward. We would kind of bounce around a little bit from, we were actually attending buildings that were not even in our stake. They were pretty far away. Like when I was in the bishopric, because they were pushing people into buildings. So, you know, we'd have our bishopric meeting at 5 in the morning or 5:30 in the morning. And I, you know, I'd have to travel 30 minutes to get to that building.
Wow. And so 5:30. Wow.
Yeah. So it was pretty crazy. And, you know, our bishop's office was a classroom that they had to use.
Oh, wow.
So
just making it work.
Yeah. Just making it work. And, you know, they were trying to build the buildings and the church did get those done, but, so there was always a space issue. And, most of our, meetings would take place here at, you know, in somebody's home. We instead of going all the way out to the church, we would try to do scouts and stuff at somebody's house or, you know, so that we weren't traveling so far, all the time, which is probably, you know, so from some of our friends in the mission field, that's probably, they're probably not too surprised with that, but
yeah,
Arizona is a pretty LDS place and not huge like Utah, but there's quite a few stakes and wards around. So it was kind of strange. So
cool. So in your time as bishopric, you were released after that 4 or 5-ish years. And then how long was it the next, you know, significant leadership calling as bishop or what happened between that bishopric and bishop?
Served as a counselor to a wonderful bishop, an older gentleman, he had kids older than me. So it was quite interesting.
Yeah.
And then the other counselor, was again, kind of the same thing. I was friends with some of his kids. So, it was kind of an interesting dynamic, but we worked well together and ended up, you know, not ended up, but immediately fell in love with those guys and we're still friends to this day. We see each other and, we've all kind of moved around. They've moved around, but stayed close.
And just
close
to interject on that, on that point is, as maybe there's individuals that are listening will soon be called as bishops or Relief Society presidents or whatever it is. And just in the stake that I'm in, the area I'm in, which is quite unique for Utah and Salt Lake, but, you know, and I was called as a counselor in the bishopric at 25 and I see that happen in some wards and some wards don't do that where they, you know, that second counselor, one of the counselors is relatively young for a high priest or that calling, but I've seen many wards do that mainly out of necessity. Right. And, usually in Salt Lake, you know, there's 100 guys in the ward who could be bishop or counselor. And so, you know, it's not hard to get 3 guys that are in their late 40s, early 50s or 60s, you know, to do that. But there's such a value in calling somebody who's very inexperienced and young because it blesses the church in another 10 years. And, you know, the person I was when I was called as Elder's Quorum president before I was married in a student ward, I'm a much different leader now because somebody said, you know, well, why don't we, and it was out of necessity in my ward. I mean, the counselors were generally young, but why don't we call, you know, Brother Frankum and see how he'll do. But I learned so much in that time. And so I think it's just this idea that, you know, especially it sounded like in your area, there were plenty of people that could have served, older people, you know, that had experience, but they went with you, and obviously, I'm sure you were a very effective counselor. But I would guess that you learned an amazing amount of knowledge and experience that really prepared you to be the bishop you are today. Would you agree?
Totally agree. And I served with capable men that were, you know, I learned different things from each of them. And, you know, you're completely correct. It's, and I've kind of taken that, that lesson to heart, especially now as I'm serving as a bishop, that, you know, I heard Elder Bednar one time say in a talk, he said, somebody took a chance on you one time, you know, and you are where you are now because somebody thought, okay, let's give him a shot and see what happens. And I never have, has it failed that it, you give somebody a position of leadership that they don't step up and grow. It almost always happens. And so I was lucky or blessed that, I got to serve in that bishopric. And, basically the ward split again, and it just kind of coincided with that bishop being released, the first counselor got called as the new bishop, and that, and they put me on the high council and, served there on the high council for, a full 5 years. And that was actually probably, you know, you're always growing and you're always kind of maturing in your leadership, but serving on the high council was just a fantastic opportunity, you know, sitting in the room with 12 men, well, 15 men that, love the Lord and love the gospel and understand the gospel and, you know, have fun talking about it. And, you know, we would have some of these high council meetings that were just, you know, we'd be in there for an hour and 45, 50 minutes of it. We're talking doctrine, you know. Yeah. It was just, it was amazing
meetings.
Actually.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And then after the high council came the bishop calling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Got called as the bishop, 5 years after I put on the high council.
And I don't mean to slow this interview down by dissecting every calling along the way, but I think especially high council, being a high councilman is a unique calling because, like you said, you do have meetings with other members of the high council, the stake presidency, but a lot of the time you're sort of, you feel like an island, right? You've got these responsibilities. There's no, you don't have counselors to go to really kind of have a powwow and go through the details. Any suggestions or thoughts you have, if you could go back and talk to yourself as a newly called high councilman, any guidance you'd give yourself?
Yeah. One of the things that, that I kind of learned, and again, I think the thing to keep in mind is that we, you know, we progress, you know, we're always learning and, you know, so I've been a bishop now for 4 years. It doesn't mean I know what I'm doing. You know, you're always kind of learning and adding to your understanding. But when I was on the high council, I was lucky at first to have a ward assignment. And, so I just really tried hard to be, there as often as I could, you know, in the bishopric meetings, I'd try to be there as a help and, you know, spend time in the ward as well with mostly the elders' quorum presidents. I wasn't as successful at that as I'd like to have been. But just trying to be there in the ward, because I think, like you said, you can end up, when you're on the high council, you can kind of end up as kind of like a lone wolf, you know, you've got all kinds of responsibility, but no authority.
Yeah.
And so I just tried to stay helpful. I really did enjoy speaking, which was, you know, over 5 years I was able to give.
Man, that's a lot of talks.
A lot of talks.
Cool.
And, but really enjoyed that part of it. And I tried really hard to not be the prototypical high councilman, you know, and not everyone, you know, they get a bad rap, but, it's hard when you give 10 or 15 talks a year to keep it fresh every month, you know?
Yeah. So what would you do to keep it fresh or to organize your thoughts or, to approach a new topic every month or every few months?
Yeah. Well, and probably the biggest blessing I received from being on the high council is, the stake that I served in was very organized. So I knew my topic, a year in advance. So basically they
had
all,
that's great.
They would calendar the entire year. Here's what this, we, we use a system in our stake called the Scripture of the Month. So every month, the entire stake is kind of focusing on one scripture, and the high councilman would speak on that scripture. So what I would do is I would just start studying those scriptures the day after I gave the talk. The next month, I would start studying that and trying to put as much information in my mind as I could about that topic. And it's actually served me very well. At first, I wrote every talk out. You know, I would have 4 or 5 or 6 pages of typed talk, and I would use that as my template.
And you would read it verbatim.
Not verbatim, but I would stick pretty close to the script. And I don't know, about 3 years into my calling, I was actually speaking at the stake president's ward, and he was sitting next to me on the stand, and he saw my notes, and he took them from me, and he said, "Let me see that." And then he just put them under his chair and didn't nice. Give them back to me. And he said to me, he said, I don't ever want to see you read another talk. And so he
great advice.
Yeah. So I went from that perspective. I would take notes up with me just so I could hit bullet points, but I would just fill my mind and let the Lord, or the Spirit speak. And, that's when I became, I think, powerful as a speaker.
Great. And, yeah. Really the only time you should read a talk is if you're ever asked to speak in general conference, and that's very few people. And I think it's sort of required to do that because of time and
management. But it takes some guts. It takes some guts to get to that point. It took me a little while, but
it's
now,
a good leadership skill. Yeah, for sure. And then let me just go back. Some of these little programs I hear as I do these interviews, I'm always interested in. So the Scripture of the Month, was it as basic as that? The stake president or the stake presidency would put out, we're going to do 1 Nephi, 8 or something, and a specific verse. And then they would, all the wards would interweave that into their talks and themes of different meetings? Or how would that work?
So really the way the high council would get together with the stake presidency, and then we would discuss as a council what we felt the stake needed. And then we would try to find a scripture in the standard works that would help teach that principle. Usually there was a theme. This year, actually, our theme is the proclamation on the family, which is technically not,
canon,
standard
right,
work scripture,
yeah.
But it's scripture to us as members of the church.
Sure.
And so we took each paragraph of that, and every month they spoke, or we studied a different paragraph of it.
Oh, that's great.
And so we encourage, especially those in leadership callings to start your meeting by reading and discussing the scripture of the month, quote unquote, whatever that was. And just, it's a great way to invite the Spirit to a meeting. You know, you're not just getting right into the brass tacks of the administration part of it. You get to actually share the Spirit with one another. And it's been great. So basically, usually around November or December, we'll get the list of scriptures from the stake presidency as they've been discussed among the high council, and probably even the ward council, I'm guessing now, or the state council. And that's it. Yeah.
Cool.
It's a pretty good pro. And the thought is, if you study it and you 4 or 5 weeks out of the year, you're thinking about it, you're praying about it, you're pondering it, you're going to put it into your memory bank. And almost kind of like,
you're going to ponderize it.
I was just going to say that.
Sorry, I stole your thunder there.
Yeah, that's really what we were doing, is everybody was kind of on the same page with it. So
cool. All right. Well, I love these details. If I keep going this way, I'm going to take 3 hours of your day here, so I'll try and speed it up. Let's get to quickly. Just give us the story. Just give us your story of when you were called as bishop, like how that went down.
So, it was kind of a very surreal weekend. The stake president who called me, I sat on the high count. He was a high councilman or high counselor, whatever we call them, before he got called as a stake president. And so was kind of a dear friend. Again, one of these older, he's much older than, not much, but you know, again, kids my age.
Sure.
So, but he was a friend. And so sitting on the high council with him as the stake president was pretty unique and really fun. I admired him as a leader. I actually he'd been a bishop before and all kinds of stuff, and came from a very prominent family in our area. And so I just really, again, just ripped as much off from him as I could. And so I didn't even suspect it because, anyway, I'd been out on an anniversary weekend with my wife up in a little town called Sedona. Got home, went to church the next day, and get a call from the executive secretary. Hey, President Allen needs to speak with you. Bring your wife. And I knew immediately that was not, you know, you don't bring your wife for any other reason. So I'd kind of knew what was going to happen. And, but I wasn't expecting the ward. What happened is they were splitting our ward again. And so they took two wards and created three basically. And, called me and four other guys from the high council at the same, on the same weekend, because they're doing a big stake reorganization. So four of us got pulled off the high council and put into as bishops. And, yeah, it was cool. Interesting. I remember him bringing me in and my wife, and he asked my wife if I was worthy to do it.
Yeah.
I just thought, oh no. But you know, I had been prepared. I felt like my whole life, Heavenly Father's taken care of me that way, that he's put me in positions to be as useful for him as I can. And, yeah. I've always kind of felt like, especially up to that point. Now, again, it was a gut check moment. In fact, they had to have a big special stake meeting when they sustained all of us bishops, because there were so many changes being made in the stake. I remember when they called my name and asked me to come forward so that I could be sustained. I don't know. I got like three steps out of my seat and I started to kind of whimper. I thought, oh, I hope nobody hears me do that. But, just the surreal, okay, this is, you know, time for me to, you know, I thought I had dedicated a lot of my life before him, and now this is real.
So. Yeah. And it again goes back to that, you know, back when you were 26 and a bishop took a chance on you, or when your elders quorum president, someone took a chance on you. Now all that experience is paying off and is really blessing the church, because you at least had some idea of, you know, where the office was, what you do with tithing envelopes, you know, those little things, but also just good leadership experience that really was a blessing in that moment when you were asked to step up.
Completely. I completely agree with that. So.
Cool. All right. So you, as I always do with these interviews, I had you send me five key leadership principles that you sort of, you know, if you were to write your memoir someday, or the leadership book for, you know, Bishop Mikos, this would maybe be some points you'd hit. So let's just run through those and maybe speak to them, why they came to your mind as you were writing this list. So the first one is let leaders lead.
Yeah. I had seen, ultimately, you know, in my leadership, in both being on a mission and, you know, serving in elders' quorums and bishoprics, that, you know, there's a couple different ways that you can lead. And, I felt like, micromanaging is not the best way. And I still feel that way. If we're inspired as a bishopric to call somebody to a calling, then, that was for a reason. And so I believe in giving people space, you know, specifically once they've been set apart, they receive, you know, kind of delegated authority, delegated keys, if you will, to do their job. And so I'm a big believer in, you know, the primary president runs the primary, and I ask her for her advice. I'll never tell her, unless it's something very procedural, you know, how to do her job. And so, you know, that's kind of the theory behind that, is let leaders lead. And, you know, sometimes, and I'll be honest, the best lessons are learned by making mistakes. And so as long as it's not catastrophic or anybody's in danger, you know, yeah, go ahead, try that if you want to try it, you know, let's see how it goes. And, you know, sometimes I'm thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be a disaster. And it turns out great, you know, and sometimes it does turn out to kind of fall on its face, but lessons are learned. And that's the important thing.
Yeah, so. For sure. Cool. The next one you mentioned was make bad men good and good men better.
Yeah, that's a quote I heard President Hinckley give. And I had always attributed it to him, but I think he stole that from, President McKay or somebody. But we've kind of been hitting on this this theme the whole time, is that somebody took a chance on me. And so somebody may not look like an elders quorum president, or they may not look like a primary president or a relief society president or young men's president. You know, we definitely want to call people we know are going to function in the position, but we want to make good men better. We want to give people opportunities to grow. And the genius to me of the gospel, or of the church, I should say, not the gospel, of the church, is this lay leadership that we have. And really, you know, nobody gets hurt, you know, in the church. Maybe a program doesn't run the way you want it or the best way it could, but that person who sat in that position as a counselor in a bishopric or a counselor in a young men's presidency, you know, their capabilities have grown from the opportunity. So, you know, so the first part of that, make bad men good, is obvious that we're always trying to find ways to help everybody that can come to the gospel. But then making good men better is, you know, we're all good men, and, you know, how do we make, or good men and good men, women, how do we make everybody better? Giving people opportunities to serve, to me, is one of those big, big ways, especially as a bishop, that I can do that.
Cool. Next one you put, I think a very important principle, is always be training your replacement.
Yeah. Again, a talk or a training that I had heard Elder Bednar give, which has been very useful to me, is that, you know, as a bishop or as an elders quorum president, you know, giving people those opportunities to learn the lessons you wish you would have learned. You know, I think that's the first part of it. And also letting people do the work. As a bishop, sometimes it's like, okay, if I just step in here and do it, it's going to be so much easier. It'll take less time, less effort. But in reality, it's not true. If you can step back, and maybe it takes one or two times for that person to learn how to do that thing that the bishop could be doing, they eventually learn it and then can do it. And you know, you're basically giving those brethren or sisters the opportunity to become your replacement in some way, shape, or form. You have to learn to delegate, which is difficult, to do. One, I think if everybody was honest, there's a certain amount of pride, to what you're doing. You don't want to feel like, hey, if this doesn't work out well, I'm going to look bad. Which is completely the wrong motivation. But I think it's a human, it's a natural man part of us, but you got to do it. You got to let go, and you got to, know that, you know, the Lord's going to make sure that nothing horrible happens. And in the long run, if I got, you know, 50% home teaching or 75% home teaching for that month, but somebody, you know, grew into be a better leader, it's probably more important than anything. So,
yeah. And I was just discussing this concept with a friend, who was recently, he's actually one of my counselors when I served as a bishop, and he was recently called as bishop. And he kind of talked about this in the terms of the vacuum that you create when you're removed from a calling. And this I'm experiencing firsthand, now just being released as bishop, is I kind of look back and think and analyze, is how strong is that vacuum when I was removed from it? And actually, this coming Sunday is my first time I'll be going back to my ward as a member of the state presidency as no longer the bishop, right? And so it'll be interesting to see how that goes. And, you know, there hasn't been any huge revolts or complaints or anything, or, you know, the building hasn't caught on fire by any means. But it really, just hearing in that concept of what vacuum are you creating when they remove from you from that call, is, does everything break down when you're gone, or is the next person able to step up, and there's no hiccup along the way, you know? And so really powerful leadership principle there. Next one he put is shepherd people to the temple.
Yep. So I think one way or another, and I think I put my fifth one, well, I won't get to the fifth one, but this is kind of dovetails, I think, into my fifth principle, but is that the temple is the ultimate place that the bishop needs to, well, from my perspective, that the bishop needs to be focused on. If I can get families to the temple, then I have less marriage problems to deal with. I ultimately believe I have less welfare problems to deal with. So some of these more administrative things that you get caught up in, I think if you can get people focused on the temple and getting there, both through family history and actual service, that's my job as the bishop, I think, is to get people there, get those covenants made, make sure they're keeping those covenants, and or do what I can to encourage that. You can't make anybody do anything, but it, you know, be encouraging that. I think that's the best work I could be doing. You know, there's programs, there's stuff, there's all kinds of things that you can get hung up in. But if the focus is the temple, and one of the key indicators that we watch very closely in my bishopric is percentage of endowed members with temple recommends. And we talk about that almost every Sunday. You know, who's coming up for, you know, who's getting ready to expire. We're proactive. We actually, hey, brother so-and-so, your recommend expires next month. Let's go do an interview real quick, you know, and we just try to keep people focused on the temple. And we've done quite a bit this year with the last year and a half with family history as well. We have almost 10% of our ward has submitted a name for an ordinance to the temple in the last 12 months, which is, I think, something like 5 or 6 times the church average. So we really are just trying to be focusing on that. Every annual interview I give my young men and young women, as long as they're worthy, I give them a limited use recommend. And we talk about going to the temple on your own. We recently had the Phoenix Temple dedicated in the last about year, and have really focused on getting our youth to the temple to do, you know, baptisms and taking names that they've found. You know, again, just focusing on the temple, it just seems to be a great, great blessing for this area, for us at least.
Yeah, and I want to point people to Elder Bednar's talk in conference of April of 2009. He talks about this concept, as talks titled Honorably Hold a Name in Standing. And he talks about this conversation he had with a past stake president when he was called a stake president, and the importance of temple, and a great, great one for bishops and other leaders to review. All right, the last one is love is the greatest motivator.
Okay, that was okay. I couldn't remember what I sent you. My other one, then there would have been number 6 on there, was help people make the next covenant. But yeah, love is the greatest motivator. I think that needs to be the reason why we do things, and not being afraid to tell your ward family that you love them, both in public and in private. I think gives, at least me personally, it gives me power in my position. It feels like it gives me the energy and the strength that I need to deal with some of the things that sometimes, as a bishop, as you know, there's things that you have to deal with that aren't fun for you as the bishop, and they're definitely not fun for the people in your office. And if I can find a way to love everybody that I come in contact with, it makes it so much easier for me to serve them. And so I try really hard to, and you'll probably acknowledge this as a past bishop, when you get those keys given to you and you receive that mantle, there's this almost instant love that you have for people that's not normal. At least it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty selfish guy. And, but all of a sudden I fell in love with these people, and I was very concerned about, what was going on in their life. And, so I try to, you know, when I'm meeting with somebody and I kind of have an idea of what might be coming as they come to see me in my office, I try to share my love for them first before we get into the the meat of whatever it is they're coming in to talk about. And, it's helped me. I could be honest. I'd be lying if I said I was good at it, but, I think really honestly, the best motivation, is love. And when you can love somebody, it's so much easier to serve them and do the hard things that need to be done sometimes.
Nice. Well, I want to get into a little bit. I always love hearing unique technologies or programs or whatever that, you know, whatever approach you use to accomplish, like you said, maybe temple recommends, you know, getting that list of people without temple recommends lower, whatever it is. And before we get into that, I think you initially contacted me about the article and episode I recorded about the program and well, not program, but the approach I had to finding individuals in the ward. Is that accurate? Am I?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So I'd heard a podcast that you'd given about this little sheet of paper you were handing out, I think, to members of your ward about, you know, how many people are not coming, or I can't remember.
And yeah, fact, all I the people that to, we didn't, that I didn't know and that nobody knew, they were simply a name on the roll. And so yeah. I just wanted to make ward members aware of these people so they could help us find them. Right.
And mm-hmm. I was really, struck by that. And I reached out to you to see if I could get some more information, which you sent to me, and in full candor, in full honesty, I've not even really done much with that other okay. than I've been more careful. You said something in that podcast, you know, that really stuck with me. And you said, you know, ward business should be about business. And there, you know, we think that only ward business can be callings and releases, but ward business could very well be who's not here.
Yeah.
And it
the
should
problems
be.
Of the ward or yeah.
Yep. And so I've tried to be a little more diligent about, taking that ward business time to encourage and be a little more business-like, not turn the sacrament meeting away from the focus of the sacrament, but
right.
you know, who's not sitting next to you today, you know, type of a thing that was here last week.
Yeah. So yeah. And we sometimes just fall into the default of, okay, this is when we release and sustain people in the meeting. Right. But that doesn't mean you can't talk about a focus, you know, the ward theme, goals, you know, concerns that the bishop have. And like you said, it shouldn't dominate the meeting. You know, you got to get on the sacrament and that should be the focus. And then, hopefully having a spiritual component, but yeah, the handbook gives bishops and leaders a few minutes to handle ward business. So, you know, handle ward business. So
yep.
That's great.
Yeah, totally cool. Agree.
Any other technologies you use, apps,
yeah, we've tried quite a few things. I, you know, being a younger guy, am a little more, comfortable using technology, in the bishopric. And I think the church has done a lot of really cool things with some of the stuff that they're doing.
Yeah, for sure.
With LDS tools and just, you know, seems like every month they're opening up more and more functionality there. But my executive secretary is a computer programmer by trade. And he is fantastic. He is honestly probably the most valuable guy in our bishopric, present company included. So I'll come up with these things. I'll read an article. I'll see something. I'll say, hey, you know, what do you think of this? And he'll say, let me look into it. And sure enough, within, you know, a week, he's got a working prototype, you know, and so we tried quite a few different things that just didn't work super well. They worked, but we've really settled on an app called Trello, which is a project management tool. And we've basically completely reworked it to do almost everything that we do in the bishopric. The most powerful tool that we've used it for is we've basically made a living agenda. I know some people use Dropbox or something like that, or Evernote. We found Trello to work very well for us just because the ability to make simple checklists. So what happens is Sunday afternoon, my executive secretary, Brother Simon, will go in. He'll copy over the template from that day, whatever got us what done, what didn't get done, or what we added to it. and he'll make next week's agenda on Sunday. And then my counselors, myself, if something comes to mind, I jump in my phone, jump in the app, and I throw it on the agenda as a bullet point. And it's been very, very, very helpful. And then we've started using that. In fact, we just developed almost kind of a whiteboard approach to our callings. So it took a ton of time for him to set it up, my executive secretary, but he basically mapped every calling that we have in the ward and then every member that has a calling or not. And we can kind of just drop and click people into callings, and we can kind of see almost, I don't know how your mission was. In my mission, we had a big whiteboard and it had every missionary's picture on there. And then we would just move.
I think that's pretty standard. Yeah.
Yeah. When I was in the office, we would just move guys around, and I loved that, and very difficult to do in a ward setting, obviously a lot more callings, but we've kind of found this way to do it. So Trello has been awesome for us. In fact, we've got most of our stake, not most, I shouldn't say that. Quite a few wards have approached us, you know, hey, how do we use this more effectively? And we've trained our ward council on it. So now every ward council position, every auxiliary has their own Trello board where they run their own meetings and agendas out of. And Brother Simon, again, having a great executive secretary, you know, he trains a lot on that, brings guys in. Like if I'm doing my appointments on a Wednesday night, he'll call a secretary and make an appointment and say, hey, come up to the building while I'm up here with the bishop. And they sit in the office and they go through and set up Trello. So for their auxiliary. So that's been really good.
Nice. Well, to throw to quote to you in this interview, I'd rather be a pirate than a pioneer. Sounds like I need to be connected with that executive secretary. We need to get that information out there, how a bishop can use Trello to manage stuff, right?
I would definitely, I'm his greatest salesman. I mean, I think Brother Simon is, I even tell my counselors all the time, I said, you know, we all know we'd not be here without Brother Simon. So
nice. And we use, I've talked about this in other posts, I use Asana in a very similar way. It's just another project management, approach app. And it's all linked to Trello and Asana as well on the notes of this interview. But I love hearing that, using technology in that way. So, yeah. Well, wow, we have covered a lot, Chance, and I appreciate you taking the time to do this. It has been so valuable, and I think others will find value in this as well. And as a tradition goes on this podcast, the last question I have for you is, as you've served in Elders Quorums, bishoprics, and now as bishop, how have you become a better disciple of Jesus Christ because of these leadership callings?
Yeah, I think the best thing about it, as I've thought about this question, is, you know, we go on missions when we're 19 and 20 and 21 or whatever, and we learn the most valuable lesson in discipleship, and that's how to love people. And I think we come home, we get married, we have kids, we get a job, and we forget that that's the most important thing. And these leadership positions, again, as I've kind of alluded to, I think they, at least for me, they have kind of forced me to remember that, that, you know, a true disciple loves God's children, and all that we should want to do is to help them be better people and get back to live with Heavenly Father again someday. I think if I could boil it all down, you know, I've learned a lot of great things. I've been able to make a lot of cool friends and fun people and learn a lot of neat things. But man, the most important thing that I've learned is that love, you know, love is the answer, and it will fix pretty much everything, every problem that we face, both I think in the church and even outside of the church. If we could learn to love better, that will make us such a better people, a better person, a better disciple of Jesus Christ, and really a true disciple. You know, I think that would be, if I was to boil it all down and make it as simple as possible, it's love.
That concludes my interview with Bishop Mikos. What a fantastic individual. I could really feel the spirit of the person he is and the way he serves, and what a great testimony. And I hope you took a lot away from that. He had some great tips. I was taking notes throughout that interview, and and great, great tips. So feel free to visit the show notes of this interview, and I'll put some links up there of different items we talked about. And check out while you're there the various options to support Leading LDS. As I've mentioned before, each episode costs me about $10 to $15 to produce, editing, and that's not even mentioned the time it takes me. And the reality is I'll put as much as my money into it as I can until my wife slaps me. But there's ways that you can help support Leading LDS so I can keep doing this. And many of you have been very generous in purchasing the food order reference guide, the consequence sticks. And even if you have one or you have no use for any of those, feel free to just buy one and give it to your bishop or your stake president or whoever it is. And it's a great gift, a great way to say thank you to them, to these leaders that sacrifice and give so much of their time. And I'm coming with other ways that you can contribute to Leading LDS. And I don't want to shake you down for money every time, but I just want to make you aware of, you know, this does cost money. And if you find value in this resource, go and purchase something. And I want to give value for value, and don't just expect you to give me your money, though you're free to do so if you want to do that. And we are in the process of setting up a nonprofit so that you can do so and not pay taxes or however that works. Anyways, but it's a valiant effort that I'm excited to be a part of, and any contribution that you would give would be much appreciated. So until next time, be a leader and not a calling.